Two of the hottest topics in the tech world over the past year have been cybersecurity and personal privacy. And that's been clear at the International Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. When Federal Trade Commission Chairwoman Edith Ramirez addressed the conference this week, she called on companies that make internet-connected devices to build in protections for consumers from the outset.
Companies should conduct a privacy or security risk assessment as part of the design process. They should test security measures before products launch. They should use smart defaults, such as requiring consumers to change default passwords in the setup process.
Privacy and security are also focal points on the CES floor for the first time this year. More than 80 vendors are showcasing related products. Lindsay Turrentine, editor-in-chief of CNET.com, has been talking with those vendors. She joins us from the Las Vegas Convention Center. Lindsay, welcome.
Thank you.
And you've been checking out the products on the floor since Tuesday. What are some of the things you've seen in what's called the personal privacy marketplace there?
Well, we've seen a lot of products that are dealing with payments, especially since Apple Pay came onto the market recently. We've seen some interesting products that make payments easier for people who might not own the newest smartphone. One I saw was called Hyper 3 from a young company that creates a small device that's essentially it's like a key fob. You can stick it to the back of your phone or you can carry it near a phone, and it works with your phone to act as a digital wallet. So it securely stores your credit card information. You use your fingerprint to use it to pay anywhere that accepts digital payments.
And the question, if it's part of the personal privacy marketplace, the assumption is that this will be more secure than other ways of payment?
Yes, because it uses multiple factors for authentication, and that's basically a fancy way of saying that it uses something you are, your fingerprint in this case, something you have, which is the device it's paired with, like your phone, and something you know, which is the password you use to get into your phone. And so it creates a unique identifier for each session when you use it. So there's really no single password that gets stored.
Let's listen to a bit of a keynote address that was given by the CEO of Intel, Brian Krzanich. He was trying to demonstrate using facial recognition as part of home security. And here's what happened.
So you can see she walks up. Her phone is authenticated. She shows her face. The face is authenticated. The alarm is disabled, and the next step, the door is unlocked. The door is unlocked. The door is unlocked. Oh, there it goes.
So a few hiccups along the way, but I gather the door did eventually work. Does this point to some hurdles for tech companies like this? Not everything is going to work the way it's supposed to, and with the question of security, that's a really big deal.
It is a really big deal, but I think we are getting a lot closer to using all kinds of information from your body to create a more secure environment. And so what Intel is working on is using its TrueSense cameras. These are new cameras that Intel is just introducing at CES to, they say, get rid of passwords altogether and use these biometric security points for you to log in so that you can actually use your face just sitting in front of the camera on your computer or in front of your cell phone to act as your password.
Lindsay, anything else on the floor there in Las Vegas that's really caught your eye in this field of privacy and security?
I think that I am really very bullish on the biometric security. I think that if we can get to a point where we can use our face or our fingerprint or our retina, there's a retina scanner here, to log in, that creates such a great alternative to remembering 15 different passwords that you essentially always forget and then have to create over and over and over again.
I know that feeling.
Oh, yes. It can be incredibly irritating.
Lindsay Turrentine, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Lindsay Turrentine is editor-in-chief of CNET.com. She joined us from this year's International Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas.
Today in the journal Science, researchers introduced a computer program that can outwit any human on the planet at poker. To help explain how this gambling robot beats the odds, NPR's Jeff Brumfield goes back to last year's World Series of Poker.
And there it is, the pocket nines for Jacobson.
The final was broadcast on ESPN. This particular type of poker is called Texas Hold'em. Don't worry if you don't know the rules. Players have cards, they bet, then they show their hands, and one person takes the pot.
Martin Jacobson has his breakthrough win. He has climbed the mountain, and his poker's 2014 world champion.
Poker isn't just a game of chance. It's a mixture of luck, statistics, and psychology. You need to know the odds, know whether your opponent is bluffing. You've got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away. Enough. Michael Bowling is a computer scientist at the University of Alberta in Canada who invented the new program. He's played poker in Vegas once.
I actually did phenomenally well out of pure luck, and so I'm just going to never gamble again and be up on Vegas.
But Bowling loves thinking about all the strategies for playing poker.
Well, there are 10 to the 14, which is 10 trillion different decision points in the game. So the actual number of ways of playing is an astronomically large number.
And it turns out one of these trillions of strategies can beat all the others. It doesn't matter if your opponent is a master bluffer or a blundering amateur. A computer with that strategy can eventually win. It took Bowling years to find it. His team had to crunch the strategies with supercomputers. But eventually they came up with the perfect strategy. Well, almost perfect.
It's just a tiny bit off, and that tiny bit is so small that even if you played a lifetime, 12 hours a day, 200 hands an hour for 70 years, you still wouldn't be able to tell it apart from actually having played a perfect game.
It does have limitations. It can only play one opponent at a time, and the version of poker it wins at isn't exactly like what's on TV. But that doesn't matter to Bowling. Remember, he's not a gambler. He hopes the program he's developed can make computers generally better at making decisions when faced with uncertainty. Still, this left me wondering, are there any games for humans to win? I called Oren Etzioni, the head of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence, and asked him, maybe Connect Four?
The computer will never lose in Connect Four.
Checkers.
The computer will beat you.
Backgammon.
The computer is playing at the level of the world champion.
Parcheesi?
I don't know Parcheesi. It sounds kind of cheesy.
I don't think anyone plays Parcheesi anymore. Maybe I could win on that ground.
Yeah.
Actually, Etzioni says humans still have an edge. Chess computers, poker computers, Parcheesi computers, if they exist, they're all completely different.
It's not the same program that's doing this. It's very, very different computer software.
A single human brain, on the other hand, can play all those games, even if it loses. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News. You got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting.
The International Consumer Electronics Show came to a close yesterday in Las Vegas. The show is a show. Meant to be a happy time, part business, part performance, lots of partying. And it's a time to put on a good show, even if you're not certain about the future of your company. The CEO of Intel, the chip maker, is in exactly that awkward position. NPR's Arthi Shahani takes a look at why. Welcome to the new
ways, to the new age. It's showtime. Only at this week-long Gadget Fest, the musicians aren't the rage. The engineers are. The opening night headliner is the CEO of Intel Corporation.
So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming back to
a man named Brian Krzanich. Tens of thousands of people expect to be dazzled, and Krzanich steps up to dazzle us with this.
Nixie, the first wearable camera that can fly.
Meet Nixie, the must-have drone whose legs can fold around your wrist like a watch band. And when you want that selfie from the sky, unclasp it so it can hover around you and shoot.
Now, those of you in the audience, get your cameras ready because we're about to witness history here.
We watch Nixie take the first ever flying photo on the stage of this electronics show, and it's made possible by an Intel chip.
Okay, let her go.
For an hour, Krzanich uses whiz-bangy technology to make a case. Just like Google is the software platform for developers around the world, Intel, the chipmaker, is the hardware platform. From drones to refrigerators to bracelets, if it computes, if it's smart, if it needs to communicate, it should be done with Intel inside. At least, that's the hope.
It's a hard slog, and it can look like your divorced uncle going out dancing on a Friday night.
Michael Malone is author of the book, The Intel Trinity.
This is a 50-year-old company or 45-year-old company trying to look young again.
Intel fell behind the smartphone revolution. It's now betting on the wearable device movement, like the drone watch, even though it might flop. And according to research sponsored by Intel, customers are not sold. But Malone says Intel has to show the world that it's trying.
And they're not stodgy old Intel. You know, they're making connection with a lot of interesting folks that are doing interesting things.
The fashion industry works very different than the classic tech industry.
That's the CEO, Brian Krzanich, talking to me offstage about the companies he's working with in this wearable era.
They're used to changing product right up into the last moment as fashion and what's desirable shifts. And that's something we've had to adapt to.
Brands like Oakley sunglasses and Fossil watches are really different from the old PC makers and from each other. Even if Intel could figure out a button-sized superchip to serve every partner's needs, they've still got to get the price right. Back in the PC era, Intel sold chips for as much as $1,000 and had nice margins. But when I roam this convention floor and ask device makers what they'd pay for a quality chip, I get single-digit answers.
Under a dollar.
It's a dollar, $2.
A couple dollars, you know, $5, $6 for a good chip on that.
Intel chips, which are more than good, might be overkill. And so as CEO Krzanich walks past poker tables to lead Intel demos, he himself is making a gamble. Arthi Shahani, NPR News, Las Vegas.
This week, tech companies showed off their latest and greatest at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Wearable tech, like Google Glass, has been the hot trend lately, along with ultra-high-definition 4K TVs. But is that actually what any of us want? Alan Murray is the editor of Fortune magazine, and he was at the CES this week. Alan, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
So Fortune actually did a survey of consumers asking them what they want in terms of electronics, and what did you find?
Well, what we found was the number one thing that consumers want is for their batteries to last longer.
So, yeah.
You know, I have to tell you, I was struck by that poll result as I was walking around the convention center. You have to realize this is like 2.5 million square feet of display space with all these drones flying around and these mammoth curved televisions with 4K ultra high definition and an awful lot of people running around trying to find power strips so they could plug in their smartphones that had run out of battery juice.
They're not asking for Google Glass or other wearables or hoverboards. They just want better batteries.
Very little interest in wearables. Very little knowledge, frankly, in 4K television.
Now, when you say very little demand, how little is that? How many people want Google Glass, for instance?
Single digits wow. Expressed an intention to buy a smartwatch or some sort of wearable connected device in the next year. I think the real challenge for Apple in particular, which is coming out with its smartwatch in the next years, can they do what they did with the iPod and the iPad with the smartwatch? Can they create the demand by introducing something that sounds so exciting and compelling that you feel like, even though you didn't previously want one, now you do. But it better have a good battery in it.
So do you think that you're talking about Apple and the iPod, that old Steve Jobs famous line that people don't know what they want until you show it to them. Do I really want wearables and I just don't realize it yet?
It could be. I think that's what we'll find out. But, you know, sometimes these things fail. I mean, a great example, a few years back, the big thing at the CES show was 3D television. Mm-hmm. And everybody thought this is going to be the next big thing. And they were pushing them out like mad at Best Buy and all the consumer electronics shows. And it was a big flop. People don't want to sit in their living room and wear silly looking glasses while they're watching TV.
And Alan, was there anybody at the CES with a magnificent battery display? Showing like some sexy new batteries.
No, I'm sure somewhere in those 2.5 million square feet of product, there were people selling battery products, but there was not a lot of talk or buzz about the big battery breakthrough. Everyone knows it has to happen. The last thing people want is to have their smartwatch become one more thing that has to be plugged in and charged at night or even during the day. I mean, imagine it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and your watch suddenly runs out of power. You know, this is a problem waiting to be solved. And I didn't get any sense in my 3 days at the Consumer Electronics Show that the solution is about to happen.
That's Alan Murray. He's the editor of Fortune magazine, and he joined us from New York. Alan, thanks very much.
Great to be with you.
Pretty soon, sports fans won't need a cable or satellite subscription to watch the big game on ESPN. That's thanks to a new streaming service from Dish Networks called Sling TV. NPR TV critic Eric Deggan says platforms like this are redefining the industry and how we watch television.
Tina Fey is coming back to Sirius TV for the first time since her show 30 Rock ended in 2013. And she's already got an idea for how her new show will be different now that it's airing on Netflix instead of NBC.
I think season 2 is going to be mostly shower sex.
Yes.
She was cracking jokes at a press conference for TV critics, but she also had a point. Faye's new show, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, was developed for NBC. But when the network couldn't find a good time slot, they cut a deal to move it to the streaming service Netflix. There, the show has no official language restrictions, no content restrictions, and no time slots.
We can make a show work on its own merits.
That's Ted Sarandos, chief content officer for Netflix.
If it would have gone the NBC route, it would have been, you know, I didn't know what night it was on. It got preempted by a football game. It was all the different things where that keep people from having that deep relationship with programming that they used to have.
Ask if this new way of watching TV comedy will obliterate the broadcast networks, though, and Faye's not quite ready to go there yet.
I think the future is a mix. People still have the communal feeling when the next season of Orange is the New Black goes up, and they do want to talk about it. They want to email about it. They want to talk about it at work. So you still have the communal feeling of like, oh, we all want to see this and talk about it right now. But it's just not literally at that specific hour of the night.
In fact, there's several new streaming services coming in 2015 to give viewers more control. HBO and CBS have announced services, but Dish Networks got a lot of attention at the Consumer Electronics Show by unveiling its Sling TV, mostly for this reason.
This is SportsCenter.
We are just 2 days away from Super
ESPN Center. And ESPN2 are among a slimmed-down package of channels offered by Sling TV for a $20 monthly subscription. It'll be the first time viewers can stream ESPN channels without paying for a cable subscription, a development that hints at a future without cable television. But James Rollins, vice president of digital distribution for ESPN, said during a press conference that Sling TV was mostly a way to target people who have broadband internet service but don't buy cable television.
We see this as being kind of supplemental. It's going to be additive in a way to serve a market that's been underserved, be that bridge into higher tiers of service.
If you're not getting to those audiences where they want to be watching and where they want to be shifting their time, you are leaving them behind.
Eric Flanagan is an executive vice president at Viacom Entertainment Group. He says viewers have grown to expect access to TV shows when they want, where they want, thanks to the digital video recorder.
The DVR was the first thing that put you off the clock and on your own schedule and essentially watching shows when you wanted to watch them, binge view them when you wanted to watch them. Then you throw the streaming services onto that and you start to get all these what are now new behaviors.
Flanagan works on TV everywhere. It's an effort by the cable industry to give subscribers access to their channels over the internet on laptops, tablets, and smartphones. Flanagan says a service like Sling might help Dish hold on to customers who would otherwise cut the cord and drop their subscriptions, either because they want lower payments or because they watch TV differently.
I tend at this moment to pull out my phone and say, people for whom this is their first screen, not their second screen. I think having some answer to those folks is something we need to do.
Netflix content chief Sarandos says their data shows people watch TV differently when they use their service.
Everything that's watched on Netflix is watched super deliberately. It's not background noise. It's not just, you know, what's something you turn on and you go off and eat dinner and watching the same show until you're done. This is much closer to books where people are really saying, no, I'm going to start Breaking Bad tonight.
At a time when everyone in the TV industry is trying to guess what the future holds, it seems that technology and services that meet viewers' new on-demand attitudes are the surest way to success. I'm Eric Deggans.
Since the United States accused North Korea of being behind last month's cyber attack on Sony, some internet security experts suggested the blame may actually lie elsewhere. Among them was Norse Corporation, who are now working with the U.S. government on the Sony investigation. On the Norse website, there's a virtual war room map. You can see multiple attacks launched every second, hitting their targets halfway around the globe. Kurt Stamberger is the senior vice president at Norse. He says Norse uses a global network of 8 million sensors, disguised to look like attractive targets.
They pretend to be a point-of-sale machine, a credit card swiper, an ATM terminal. They pretend to be a piece of industrial equipment on a plant floor. And based on the intelligence that we get back from this network, we can tell who's attacking what types of devices, and we can also profile the types of actors that are unleashing these attacks.
The attack on Sony, was that different just in terms of the scale of the attack, or were the attackers using a different approach, a different way in than these daily attacks that we're talking about?
Well, we really can't comment in any depth about the Sony hack because all of the data that we've generated and the investigations that we've done have been turned over to the FBI. That being said, the attacks that we saw on Sony did not seem to be fundamentally unusual from a mechanical standpoint. They used pieces of malware that had been seen in the wild in the past. They used techniques that are well understood. Some of the interesting things about the Sony attack was how targeted it was. A lot of malware is a little bit like a Roomba. You know, it's a little robot that runs around the carpet and bumps into furniture and then turns right and then bumps into something else and turns left. And when it runs across a piece of dirt, it picks it up. This malware that was deployed against Sony was a lot less like a Roomba and a lot more like a cruise missile. It had credentials, server addresses, digital certificates, all these things that were built into the malware that allowed this malware to target that organization and extract information and be very destructive.
Kurt, finally, I think I want you to talk me down a bit because looking at that map, all these attacks happening every second of every day, it is scary. Should I feel so frightened?
Frankly, yes.
no.
It's... it should disturb you.
Now, we should say, in fairness, it serves your corporate interest to say it, right?
Right, exactly. 2014 was by far the worst year ever for cyber attacks. It grew by an amazing amount, both in terms of the dollars lost and the sheer destructiveness of the attacks. This is a war that the hackers are winning right now. So it behooves listeners and everyday citizens to take some basic steps to protect themselves, change their passwords, use different passwords at different sites, keep basic security software on your machine up to date, use a firewall, ask a friend if this all intimidates you and you're not quite sure how your machine is set up, and ask for help from professionals because this is real. It is growing very quickly and it is impacting the flow of commerce on the internet.
Kurt Steinberger is a senior vice president at the IT security company Norse. Kurt, thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.